Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, March 27, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call. Today's call is on the National Labor Relations Board's new representation case rule. My name is David Ray, and I'm the Practice Group's Associate Director at the Federalist Society. And as always, I want to remind everyone that all expressions of opinion are those of our experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. And today, we welcome our experts, Homer Deakins, who is the Chairman Emeritus at Ogletree Deakins Nash Smoke & Stewart, and Mr. Brent Guerin, who is the Deputy General Counsel of Local 32BJ of the Service Employees International Union. Also today, we have a guest moderator, Mr. John Rodabaugh. He is formerly a member of the National Labor Relations Board, and he is currently both the Reed Larson Professor of Labor Law at Ave Maria School of Law, and he's an attorney at the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation. More complete bios of our speakers were provided to you in the notice of the call, so we'll stop there and preserve a little bit more time for our presenters, followed by your questions. Mr. Rodabaugh, the floor is yours.
Thank you, David. We are privileged to have two very experienced and highly respected labor law experts speak with us today regarding the National Labor Relations Board's final rule on representation case procedures. Mr. Homer Deakins is with the international labor and employment law firm Ogletree Deakins. He is a highly respected attorney who specializes in labor relations and employment law. Brent Guerin is Deputy General Counsel of the 145,000-member SEIU Local 32BJ, and previously worked for the International Ladies Garment Workers Union and served as General Counsel for Unite Here and later Workers United. Both of our speakers are experts in labor law and have contributed greatly over the years to the development of law in this field. On December 15, 2014, the National Labor Relations Board published a final rule amending its representation case procedures, which will become effective on April 14, 2015. According to the board, the final rule retains the essentials of existing representation case procedures, but removes, quote, unnecessary barriers to the fair and expeditious resolution of representation cases, end of quote. Among other things, the rule shortens the election process to as few as 14 days from the current median time of 38 days, requires employers to give unions, employees personal telephone numbers and email addresses, and makes post-election appeals discretionary with the board rather than as of right. The board issued a notice of proposed rulemaking on June 22, 2011, and published a final rule in the Federal Register on December 22, 2011, to be effective April 30, 2012. Rule was challenged and never implemented. The U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia invalidated the rulemaking in 2012, finding the board's records did not show that the then three members had approved the rule. The board then appealed the court ruling, but later dismissed the appeal and rescinded the rule changes. In February 2014, the board issued a new notice of proposed rulemaking, held a public hearing, and the board adopted the proposed rule 3-2 with some modifications on December 12, 2014, to be effective this coming April 14. The board's December 12, 2014 statement and the fact sheet, which is on the NLRB webpage announcing the final rule, asserts that, first, it modernizes board procedures by providing for electronic filing and transmission of election petitions and other documents, requiring that additional contact information, personal telephone numbers, email addresses of employees be included on voter lists to the extent such information is available to the employer, in order to enhance a fair and free exchange of ideas by permitting other parties to the election to communicate with voters about the election using modern technology. Second, the board says that it streamlines board procedures and reduces unnecessary litigation by requiring non-petitioning parties to respond to the petition and to state their positions generally before the pre-election hearing begins. Only issues necessary to determine whether an election should be conducted will be litigated, allowing the regional director to defer litigation of eligibility and inclusion of the appropriate voting unit to the post-election stage, and allowing all parties oral argument before the close of the hearing with written briefs allowed only if authorized by the regional director. Third, according to the board, the new rule increases transparency and standardizes board processes. By earlier and more complete information to the parties and employees, and pre-election hearings generally set for 8 days following service of notice and petition filing on the parties and post-election hearings, if approved, within 21 days following the tally of the election ballots. The final rule has been challenged in lawsuits brought by employer associations in the U.S. District Courts for the District of Columbia and the Western District of Texas. The complaints allege the rule will restrict communication between employers and employees before an election, depriving employers of due process and speech rights and employees of information needed to decide intelligently how to vote. The final rule also faces a congressional challenge to block the regulation under the Congressional Review Act, which would then face the likelihood of a presidential veto, as well as budget amendments to prohibit the board from requiring employer submission of employee phone numbers and personal email contact information. The Senate passed the Joint Resolution 8, disapproving the board's rule by a vote of 53-46 on March 4. Finally, let us remember that the National Labor Relations Act extends rights only to employees to, among other things, self-organize, to form, join, or assist labor organizations, to bargain collectively through representatives of their own choosing, and to engage in other concerted activities for the purpose of collective bargaining or other mutual aid or protection, or to refrain from any or all such activities. The freedom to choose is inherently predicated on knowledge of the advantages and disadvantages of voting for or against collective representation. Now it is my pleasure to turn to Mr. Homer Deakins of Ogletree Deakins. Thank you, Homer.
Thank you, John, and good afternoon, everyone. First of all, let's put the new election rules in context. The Obama NLRB has already taken numerous steps to help their union friends. Decisions in specific cases have changed legal principles which have been in place for many years. Specialty health care authorizing micro units is one example. Meanwhile, the General Counsel of the Board has issued a number of memoranda dealing with injunctions, which are designed to tip the scales toward unions, especially in the context of union organizing campaigns. Nevertheless, the new rules, which are accurately described as the ambush election rules, are the most dramatic actions thus far, and they have the potential to actually help unions gain members, which other board actions have attempted but failed to do. So I start by saying, employers beware. In discussing these new rules, I think we need to first step back and look at the basic purpose of the National Labor Relations Act. That purpose is to protect employee rights to unionize or not unionized. And to carry out this purpose, the Act prohibits employer conduct of certain types and union conduct of certain types. Unions often say that the purpose of the Act is to encourage collective bargaining. That is not the case. It protects collective bargaining only to the extent employees choose to engage in collective bargaining. The ambush election rules do nothing to protect employee choice. The purpose of the new rules is very different. Its purpose is to help unions organize, and it does this by these means. Number one, it dramatically speeds up the time before employees vote in the election, thereby limiting the employee's right to make an informed decision on unionization. Secondly, it prevents employers from having a hearing to determine the eligibility of employees in contested classifications, such as who is a supervisor. Number three, it prevents many employees from even knowing whether they're eligible to vote. And number four, it mandates that the employer must furnish information to the union despite the risk of identity theft or the invasion of privacy, which the board describes as simply, quote, a risk worth taking. First, let's understand. The rule does not speed up the representation process. It just speeds up the voting. The theory is, get the ballots in the box and later decide bargaining unit issues. That's based on the naive view. Why decide when the number of contested votes may not be material to the final results? Let them vote challenge ballots. Well, let's take an example. The most important eligibility question in most cases is the supervisory status of certain employees. If the employees are supervisors, the employer must be sure to instruct these employees on the restrictions which apply to them in the campaign, including an instruction that they must not engage in union activity. On the other hand, if the employees are not supervisors, they must be free to engage in such activity. The result is that without a hearing and without litigating the issue, the employer acts at its peril and opens himself up to an unfair labor practice and valid objections to the election if he answers the question wrong. Also, if the number of challenge ballots does not affect the results of the election and the union wins, the issue of eligibility is left for bargaining, which is unheard of. If the employer takes a position in bargaining that is ultimately wrong and insists to impasse on that position, isn't he subject to an unfair labor practice charge of bargaining in bad faith? The consequence of all this is that it's more likely that the rule will cause further litigation with significant delays, and the final resolution will take much longer. The rule is a solution in search of a problem. Speed alone is not a reason. The system for conducting elections has been in place for decades, and it has never worked better than it works today for unions. Over 90% of elections are by the consent of the parties. In the last 10 years, the board has conducted elections with a median of 38 days, well below the board's time target. Over 90% of elections are within 56 days. And the latest figures show that unions win almost 70% of elections, more than any time ever before. Unions sometimes say you need to shorten the time for elections to ensure that employers have less time to coerce employees. First of all, in issuing its proposed rule, the board asked for no comments on such an argument, and the board did not in any way rely on such an argument for enacting the quickie election rules. Secondly, that argument overlooks the drastic steps the General Counsel has taken in recent years to seek injunctive relief in union campaigns to, quote, nip in the bud employer misconduct. There has never been more government action to ensure against employer misconduct than there is today. What unions really want is silence by employers, to deny them the right to free speech, which is a right protected by the First Amendment as well as the Act. And not even the Obama board can change that. John?
Well, thank you, Homer. And now, Brent.
Okay, thank you, John, and thank you, Homer. I must say it was Homer's presentation I thought was very articulate, and there probably wasn't one word in it that I agreed with. So let me get into that. I think the first thing to understand is that the rule, as people refer to it, is a series of steps, many of which are uncontroversial, many of which the Republican members of the board agreed with. So included in the rule is such things as allowing filing the petition electronically, simultaneous filing of the showing of interest, having the employer immediately post an election notice, eliminating the mandatory 25-day delay after a hearing if there was a request for review, and including the work location shift and job classifications for employees in the lists of employees in the Excelsior list. The streamlined objection procedures, all of that's in the rule. All of that is obviously useful, modernizing, transparent, and uncontroversial. There are a number of other things that are part of the rule that I believe should fall into the same category, although the dissenters did not sort of note their agreement with this, and perhaps they don't agree. But there's more information provided to the voters and to the parties in the board's notices, that there's moving the challenges to the regional director's decisions to post-election review rather than pre-election, specifying the mechanics of the election where you get the party's positions on things like time, date, and place for the election, and hopefully foreign languages. All of that is brought into the process much quicker. And so the rule as a whole, taken as a whole, has any number of, as I said, uncontroversial improvements in the board's process. Now, the attack on the rule as being creating quickie elections, I think, is entirely misplaced. And the heart of the problem is this. For anybody who's practiced in this area knows it is the employer's interest to delay the election as long as they can. And some employers and their representatives are more aggressive about that and others less. But I've been doing this for 30 years and I have sat through hearings because the employer said, well, we don't know if the International Ladies Garment Workers Union is a labor organization or not, which is a completely frivolous position, but the employer demanded and could get a hearing on a completely frivolous point simply to create delay. I sat through hearings when we petitioned for a warehouse unit, and the warehouse happened to be near the corporate headquarters, and the employer said that it wanted all the corporate headquarter employees included in the unit with warehouse employees. Again, a completely frivolous position, didn't have any support, lost, but delayed the election several months. The reality is that seeking a hearing, even today, that is under the current rules, gives the employer an extra 20 or more days to delay the election. So measures to eliminate frivolous and unnecessary litigation are in everyone's, in the proper interest, in the interest of the administration of justice. The board ends up wasting enormous resources on unnecessary hearings on frivolous issues or non-issues. Because the other thing is to add this, employers can and have done with regularity is come into a hearing, demand a hearing, and say, well, we don't know what an appropriate unit is. We don't have a position. We just want to put on evidence and let the board decide. And these measures are measures to create delay. So that's part of it. How do we address that? The board's new rule addresses that. Delay and unnecessary litigation. The other side of the coin is I simply find it unbelievable that employers are unable to communicate their point of view to employees in a week, in 2 weeks, in 3 weeks. They are, from the filing of the petition until an election, employers have all sorts of access to the employees that unions are denied. Employers can, for instance, there are a number of board cases upholding ride-alongs, where a management official rides with a truck driver, the two of them, all day long, in which the manager can, you know, argue for and explain the position of the employer. They can have unlimited compulsory one-on-one meetings, unlimited compulsory group meetings. They can festoon the workplace with vote no propaganda. Their supervisors can wear vote no t-shirts all day long and offer them to the workers. The employers have virtually unlimited ability to communicate their message, and that communication much more often than not starts long before the petition is filed. So the premise that eliminating delay and eliminating unnecessary litigation deprives the employees of information is, I think, completely meritless. So that's my time. I'll stop there.
Homer, do you wish to reply?
Well, just a couple of comments. Brent's talking about frivolous issues. I haven't contested whether a union was a labor organization in my entire career of 50 years. And issues like who is a supervisor certainly are not frivolous issues. They're issues with great consequences to the conduct of the employer and the viability of the election. Employers don't seek to delay elections as long as they can. Of course, from a campaign standpoint, an employer seeks to time his campaign so that it peaks at the time of the election. Well, unions do the same thing. Union is in complete control of when it files the petition, which sets the machinery into play, and certainly unions take far longer than 10 or 20 days to organize before they file the petition. And then under these rules, the union is now in a position to control the 10-day period in which they are to receive the Excelsior rule and shorten the election process even further.
I was going to, thank you. I was just going to note, I saw some research recently, and yes, by by IRI, which is a management side consulting firm for election issues. But their data, having looked at board election data, shows that in the standard time of 38 days, the unions have been winning 63% of the elections. And then when you reduce the time to 14 days or less, they're winning 89%.
Go ahead, John. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, if you're having a 14-day election, it's because there's a stip and the employer is probably not fighting the union. You don't end up with 14 days elections where the employer is fighting the union
but
under
it,
the current
is
rules.
Okay, but Brent, what about the situation that we've seen now for many years where to battle this problem of the 38 days, unions have been conducting campaigns for weeks, if not months. And when they file a petition, they've got not the minimum 30% joint of interest, but they've got, you know, way up 70% or more, because once they file the petition for the small employer, which is the overwhelming majority of employers in the country, that may be the first time they really focus and learn of this.
Well, I mean, I agree.
And they have very few days to then campaign.
I agree that unions spend time preparing a campaign. I don't agree that it is very often the case that employers first learn of a union campaign when the petition is filed. And there are any number of studies. One study I saw showed that in 50%, or I think it was 47%, of cases studied, there were charges filed by the union concerning employer alleged misconduct prior to the filing of the petition. Now, it doesn't matter whether the union's charges were meritorious for these purposes, but you not only had employer activity, employer knowledge before the petition was filed in those cases, but knowledge manifesting itself in some kind of anti-union campaigning, which again the union thought was unlawful, it may or may not have been. In SEIU's experience, both SEIU and the AFL-CIO surveyed its organizing directors and practicing attorneys, and the response was overwhelmingly that the common experience was that the employer was well aware of the campaign before the petition was filed. And
yeah,
of course,
and that's
it has to be, if I just one more thought, I'm
yeah,
sorry.
Geez.
It has to be put in the context that, of course, the employer is free to, and many employers do, propagandize against the union from the day of hire. It's in their employee handbooks, it can be in orientation sessions, and there's nothing many employers do. Campaign long before there's a hint of a specific union drive.
Homer, did you wish to?
Well, I just wanted to say it's in the small units where employers are often surprised by the filing of a petition. I mean, certainly larger units, the unions out there handbilling and doing other things that where the employer does know that there's union activity. But in those small units, and the Teamsters are famous for this, they organize a small group of employees, and the first the employer knows about it is the filing of the petition.
Well, I can't comment on Teamster experience. The only thing I can say is that we agree that in terms of the median number of people in a bargaining unit is in the mid-20s. So there are lots of elections in units of under 25 people. My experience with small shops like that is that there is a lot of personal contact between the workers and management, not just supervisors, but higher management. And if we are able to conduct a campaign that nobody tells management about, that's a campaign where we have all the workers are pretty close to it. That is, in my experience, extremely rare that nobody tells management, oh, somebody, you know, that's talking to me about the union.
Well, having had extensive experience with the Teamsters and other unions, that could vary by union, of course. I wanted to ask a question. I'm concerned that we go back and focus at Section 7. An employee is a citizen, just like the rest of us, and it would seem to me that the employee needs to be able to make an informed choice. Just like, you know, whether you want to go to restaurant A or restaurant B, you kind of check it out and learn and make your choice. And what my concern is particularly with the cutting back on the board procedures for conducting the hearing and gaining evidence to then make decisions as to whether or not someone is included or excluded from the unit based on supervisor status, as much as going through an election now and putting all of this at the end after the vote, so that the employee really didn't know what group he or she would truly be associated with at the time of the vote. I find that truly incredible.
Let me add to that, John, before Brent replies, and that is, if you really look at the union campaign, typically this issue of who a supervisor is can dramatically affect the reaction of the employees in the voting unit. If you've got, for example, in a production and maintenance unit, you've got what we describe as lead persons. They are directly supervising the employees in their unit or small group. And if employees and technicians look at that person and say, my goodness, if that person's going to be in the union, then we're going to have a strong union. But on the other hand, if that person is not going to be in the union, it's going to be a much weaker union. So it's helpful to the employees in the unit to know who's actually in the unit. Does it have the potential to be a strong unit, or is it more likely to be a weak unit?
Okay, so let me comment on that. There's several things. One is, I think people are dramatically overstating the change that's involved. Current board procedure, yes, has a pre-election hearing in which evidence can be introduced, but often the regional director does not make a pre-election decision on eligibility issues. So it's not as if now we always have decisions on the supervisory issue and going forward we're never going to have them. We don't always have them now, and going forward we will continue to have them where they form all the eligibility issues form a significant part of the voting population or potential voting population. So that's the first point. The change just isn't that great. The second point is that this issue has been to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals in several cases has made clear that it's permissible to go ahead and have voting where the number of people whose eligibility is an issue is limited, as long as voters know that that's the situation and that they may or may not be included. And that, of course, is, you know, part of the board's procedure now. That is the new rule. People will be clearly informed of that. That was much less clear under current procedure. The third thing is that the supervisory question, just as we've been discussing around, you know, employer knowledge of the petition, a very significant part of the campaign occurs today before there is any decision about supervisory status. The union has been out organizing. Generally speaking, the employer knows and is running an anti-union campaign, and all that can go on for several weeks or months, depending on the circumstances, before a petition is filed, and then there's a hearing, and then there's a decision. So, again, it's not that dramatic a change because that's the situation for much of the campaign time. The last point is that this is, of course, a problem for the union as well as the employer. The union, if the leads, for instance, are union adherents and they're active in the campaign, then the union risks this creating valid objections for the employer. That's a risk that we've lived with. Again, we've lived with this up until there's a decision, and it's just part of the election process. And continuing the current rule doesn't eliminate the problem.
Well, let me ask you this question. Given particularly this NLRB, won't there be an enormously high correlation of affirming super, super micro unit petitions?
Was that the question?
An employer objects to some. They want the leather high heeled women's shoes in excess of $1,000 a pair, and they find out there's three people, and then can't object to the unit. You go through the election, and then the ability at that point, once they find that the union won the three votes, what are going to be the odds of an employer even attempting to prevail in pointing out that, well, there's other pairs of shoes over $1,000 a pair are other than leather?
The subject for today's debate is not specialty health care, and I'm happy to debate specialty health care whenever anyone would like to debate me on the subject. I think it is a enormous overstatement and anyway, just really not accurate at all to talk about micro units. I don't think specialty health care changed the standard. And the cases since specialty health care, some have supported the smaller unit, and others in the retail context have found, no, that the unit that the union sought was too small and inappropriate, and the broader unit sought by the employer was appropriate. So I think employers have every chance in the world of succeeding when their position is based, has a real basis in law. And just to be clear, if the union says we want the shoe department, forget, three people within the shoe department, and the employer says, comes into a hearing and says, look, I have a witness, he's my manager, Joe Blow, he's the manager, and he'll testify that the people in the shoe department transfer in and out, interchange all the time with the handbag department and the accessories department, and they're all under one supervisor, and they all shift around, and they're all cross-trained. Not only are they going to get a hearing, they're likely to win on the merits, as in fact has happened. The key to it in terms of the rule change is they have to identify the issue the day before the hearing. And they then have to make an offer of proof and say, look, here's my witness, here's who it is, here's what they're going to say. And if that provides the basis for a meaningful dispute, then they can litigate it. What they can't do is hide the issue, have the union come to the hearing, the day of the hearing, having absolutely no idea what's at issue, which is the current state of the rule. It's the only place in our entire legal system, as far as I know, that you have hearings where one side has no idea what the issues are. So they have to identify the issues, and they have to have some evidence to support it.
All right. Now, Brent, you said you didn't want to debate specialty health care.
I'd say I didn't want to do it right now.
let me make one other point as we draw back into this, the ambush election rules. And that is, I really think that the timing of the election severely infringes on the right of employees to make an informed choice of whether they want a union. The fact of the matter is, unions tell employees only one side of the story. They tell them about the good things about the union. And it's equally clear that most employees know little or nothing about unions. Almost 94% of employees are not members of the union. And I think it's the employer's duty to truthfully educate employees about the disadvantages of the union. That is what assures employees of an informed choice. And I don't think by speeding up elections, you can have the informed choice that's so important.
Well, in addition to that, when I or you or your daughter or son apply for a job, before there's any union ever on the property or even attempting to organize, and then several years later there is an organizing campaign, and unbeknownst to them, their personal email is turned over to a third party and their telephone number. Should not an employee have the right to inform the employer that if they did provide the information to the employer, it was understood to be for the employer's use only, and or should they not have the opportunity to be informed of the future turning over to a third party and the right to say, no, you do not have my permission to do so?
Well, if I may, I think those are certainly reasonable questions. So let's just put it in context. Currently, for those who don't know, currently the board's rule, the Excelsior List rule, is that the employer has to provide names and addresses of the voters. There was discussion about whether work emails should be included. Particularly, there was a case where the people, the workforce was like on a research ship out in the ocean, and there was absolutely no other way to reach them. That was a case that came before the board. The new rule says that the employer has to provide, in addition to names and addresses, shifts, work locations, job classifications. And that is, the Republicans did not dissent from that. They agreed with that. The rule also provides that where the employer has personal emails and telephone, either home or cell telephone numbers, those have to be provided. And I believe the Republicans, the dissent's position was that's okay if there's an opt-out. So the question is, should there be an opt-out, or, you know, in this context? There are several problems with the opt-out. One is that it is a form of, it creates a record for the employer of who is attesting to their loyalty to the employer by saying, no, I don't want my numbers released to the union. It's a form of interrogation, and that's a problem. And the other part of the problem is that given everything that has been said about the importance of workers hearing both sides, and given that the employer can force workers to hear its side ad nauseum as much as it wants, all day long, day after day, week after week, that is the legal right of the employer, and nothing in the rule limits that right of the employer. Given that, it is, if you want an informed electorate, you want the union to have a chance to talk to workers who may initially not be eager to talk to the union. And in the context of, you know, if we don't get the emails and phone numbers, what we have done historically is we go visit people's homes, and which we will continue to do. But the home visit is far more invasive, far more of an infringement on someone's privacy than getting a phone call or an email. and sort of pushing, you know, making sure that we do home visits really only has the effect and purpose of making it harder for us to contact people, making it more time consuming and expensive, and thereby denying workers access to the union's message.
But the rule doesn't void home visits.
Absolutely not, and we will continue to do them.
So would
it certainly prohibits home visits by the employer.
Well, always has.
Yeah.
So always has.
That's the balance. The union can visit employees' homes every night if they want to.
But I'm just asking, are you proposing then that perhaps employers would look more kindly to giving out employee email and phone numbers if labor were willing to give up the right for home visits?
No. All I'm saying is
you want all of the above.
Yeah, but here's my point. I'm sorry if it wasn't clear. We get a list of whatever it is, 25 or 100 or 1,000 workers, and we have to contact them. Rational thing to do would be to contact lots of them by phone and email. And if somebody tells us, you know, go away, leave me alone, I never want to speak to you, we will probably not put them at the top of our home visit list. And so we may very well find situations, lots of situations, where we would otherwise go visit, say, a strong anti-union person and come knock on their door and get them up from dinner or whatever they're doing, which we could avoid if we were able to speak to them by phone first. That's my point, not that I'm agreeing to any limitation on our right to home visits.
Well, I see that our time has expired, so let's begin entertaining questions from the audience.
Well, very well. I will now open the floor to your questions. In a moment, you will hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then pound on your telephone. When we get to your request, you will hear a second prompt that will say your microphone has been turned on. You have the floor. We will be answering questions in the order in which they are received. So again, to ask a question, please push the star button and then the pound button on your phone or on your telephone keyboard. And we'll now go to the first question. I guess while we're, I apologize, I thought there was one in the queue, but while we're waiting for the first question, I don't think I heard any of you comment on, at great length, on the legislative efforts that are underway to address this. I presume even if something does pass in this Congress, it's not necessarily likely to be signed into law, but can either of you comment right now on where those legislative efforts are?
Well, it's my understanding that both the House and the Senate have passed by majority a resolution to prevent these regulations from going into effect. I'm not sure whether that resolution has been sent to the President's desk yet or not, but if it's not, it's on the way. But I clearly understand that President Obama will veto that resolution.
I agree.
Well, no, I'm not terribly surprised either. Right. I guess the question I really had is, do either of you think there's likely to be any type of serious addressing of this at the congressional level that might perhaps be palatable to the president?
I would seriously question that. I mean, President Obama in recent times has gone out of his way to express his desire to help organize labor. And so I think it's very doubtful that there would be any legislation that was not favorable to unions that he would approve.
Particularly when he's upset labor on the trade negotiations. So I think it's without question he'll be 100% supportive of labor.
Yeah, well, I mean,
yeah,
I think
speaking
that
more in terms of labor legislation. Yeah.
No, yes, exactly.
I mean, I think the whole dynamic at this point on this issue in particular, and obviously many issues, politics as a whole, is so divided on a partisan basis that sort of moderate change acceptable to both, or what's viewed as however you want to put it, some bipartisan effort here seems extremely unlikely, and in fact, you know, the act has not, Congress hasn't successfully amended the act since 1959. So this is a longstanding inability of Congress to health care, but more broadly than that, it's nothing new.
Well, while we're waiting to see if we have any additional questions, I do want to give a little plug for some of our future events coming up. On Monday, March 30th at 3 o'clock Eastern Time, we'll be having a teleforum on class action objectors. The participants will be Professor Jonathan Macy of Yale Law School and Mr. Gerald Walpin, the former Inspector General of the Corporation for National and Community Service. On Wednesday, April 1st, we'll have a teleforum on patent cases in the Supreme Court, and that presentation will be done by Professor Greg Dolan, also at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. We'll have our monthly CFPB update. That's going to be on April 15th at 12 noon, featuring both Jerry Lozier of Winston and Strawn and Professor Todd Zawicki at George Mason University School of Law. But gentlemen, I guess I'll give one more opportunity to the audience. If anyone has a question, please press star and then pound on your telephone. Well, then, gentlemen, I would say that in the course of your presentations, you must have answered everyone's question.
Right.
We do have audience members on the line, but you must have so thoroughly covered it that today we don't have any questions.
David, I want to just thank the Federalist Society for providing us this forum for these discussions. I'm delighted to have been a part of this, and I want to thank John and Brent for participating with me. It's been enjoyable.
Yes, I add my appreciation to everybody, and Homer, you in particular, for your very thoughtful presentation. So, and you too, John. Thank you very much.
And I will conclude by thanking both of you for all the contributions over so many years that you've made in the field of labor. Thank you, gentlemen.
Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I certainly want to thank our audience members who did call in and listen to our discussion. I also want to thank our speakers. We don't have a program without our speakers, so I always want them to understand that we are grateful and indebted to them for being our program and making it possible. So, thanks to all of you. A final note to everyone that this telephone call was recorded, and so it will be posted on our website as a podcast that will probably appear sometime next week. And we look forward to your joining us for next Monday's telephone call. And until then, everyone, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.